Whether you're looking for answers to specific life questions or seeking to become the best version of you possible, welcome to the Mental Breakdown and Psych Reg podcast, where we offer insight, information, and strategies based upon research and years of practice as clinical psychologists. So sit back, have a listen, and get connected with our hosts, Dr. Bernie Wilkinson and Dr. Richard Marshall. Welcome back. Richard, we just finished a great interview with Alistair Morty. Mm-hmm. And he is an accredited addiction counselor from London, but he's actually based in Thailand.
Right.
So we need to get our map for the back wall here.
We really
put
do.
Little pins in.
Okay, we're going to
do
that.
For people that we talked to.
Because we talked about
places.
Doing that before.
Yeah.
Okay, we're putting a map up.
So he's in Thailand, which affects the video some. And so when you're watching, if you watch this on YouTube, we're going to have pictures from his website up and stuff because it was grainy and there was a bit of a delay. Audio is pretty good through most of it. There's a little few parts that's a little choppy, but
you'll get
overall,
enough. You'll get enough. The viewers can get enough out of it. I was jealous listening to him.
Yeah.
What was absolutely fascinating is he was an addictions counselor in London. And he said he worked in an area of London comparable to the Bronx in New York. So it was a difficult
street-based
frontline addiction work. But he got frustrated with it because he was limited in what he could do because the British national healthcare system.
Yeah.
So they had to work within the confines of that. And with addictions, you sometimes have to go outside that.
Right.
And he chose to go to Thailand.
Yeah,
and
so
I said, why Thailand? Of all places, why Thailand?
He did that for like 8 years in London. And then in 2010 decided, going to go to Thailand.
And he mentioned somewhere that he's in recovery himself. So I think he's a recovering addict.
Right.
So he brings that perspective. But he brings this holistic approach. And one of the reasons he chose Northern Thailand, he chose Thailand because of the need, he said. That there's a need in all of Asia. And in fact, they have become the leading addictions center in all of Asia.
Right.
The private center.
Mental health, addiction specific.
Right, addiction specific center.
Yeah.
Right. But what he was able to do in Thailand, he went to the northern part of Thailand, and it's a little bit like the United States in that the northern part is mountainous and rural. The southern part is the beach, the Riviera part of Thailand that we typically hear about in our country. Or people vacation in Thailand, they're going to southern Thailand.
Mm-hmm.
He's in northern Thailand, which is an area known for healing.
That's what he said,
which was fascinating. I mean, that was one of the reasons he chose that region is that it has this tradition of healing. It's a Buddhist philosophy that's used.
Referred to as the Golden Triangle area of northern Thailand.
Right, which is where poppies were grown.
Right.
And so, but he went there, and they developed this holistic approach, which is what is envious to us, because we sit here limited by circumstance and by the conditions in the United States. And we always say, I wish we could do this and I wish we could do that. He filled his wish list by going there.
Yeah.
And the program is absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, you'll have to check out the website. The link is in the show notes. But they do all kinds of things. They include diet and nutrition and exercise and the medical aspect and the psychological aspect. And they have one particular portion of their program, they're teaching people Muay Thai, kickboxing, training them to be triathletes.
Well, he started
like
a center just for men.
Right.
He has the cabin is general, but then he has the second system that I guess they developed in 2016 called the Edge, which is designed for young men.
Right.
Interesting, because we just did a week on men's mental health.
Right.
And there is a specific need.
Yeah.
And he says men need these physical activities. They need these near-death experiences. They need to exhaust themselves physically, something which modern culture doesn't do.
Yeah.
They have to find meaning. But it's the envy part is that he was able to put together the components of the program that he felt were needed. And they do. They have five components to the program, and it must be highly effective. I don't know what their recidivism rates are. Their completion rates are very high.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I mean, 96% of people finish the program.
Yeah.
So, Fascinating. It's fascinating.
Approach. It's impressive stuff. So definitely check it out. You will have, there's links to his YouTube and Twitter and everything in the show notes, so you can follow all of his posts and all of the work that they're doing there. In
one more comment. You and I have always said, addiction's not the problem. It's right. The underlying. It's what's behind the addiction that mm-hmm. becomes a problem. And he said one of the fascinating things he said was, you know, here you have these addicts, and most programs say, here, first of all, we're going to take away the drugs.
Right.
He said, you can't just take away this thing that they've been depending on
right.
for some length yeah. of time. You remove that and you go into panic mode.
Right.
So it's a replacement.
Right.
And so his program replaces the drugs with something healthier, with
yeah.
a healthier alternative. But it takes time, and it takes this yeah. multifaceted approach.
Yeah.
So though the video and the audio are a bit of a challenge, it's well worth it.
Right.
Take a look at this, because yeah. this is the future of addiction treatment, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, well, primarily the video is a challenge, but right. the audio is pretty good.
Audio should be okay.
Yeah. So I'll be editing, and we'll see how it goes.
Just edit the daylights out of this thing.
It'd be great.
Okay.
So, all right. So definitely check out what he's doing. It's right. awesome stuff. So, all
right. We could do it here.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
They take insurance. Did you see that on the website?
But,
they take.
But you got to get to Thailand. That's $2,000 to get there.
Well. Yeah. You know.
But if you can.
That may be.
Boy, that would be the program to go to. Yeah. And they also have a wilderness program. You know, yeah. they've incorporated a wilderness program into yeah. it. So they have.
They got it going
very
on.
Very thoughtful approach.
They got it going right. on. So, all right. Mm-hmm. Well, that is it. Enjoy the podcast. Let
yes.
us know what you think, and we'll love to hear from you.
Yeah. So, yeah, I'd love to hear from you.
All right. Enjoy the podcast. Hi. Good morning.
Hi. How are you guys?
Good. Good morning, but it's really evening for you, right?
Yes. About five yeah. in the afternoon. Yeah.
Wow. Well, it's 5 a.m. here, so we're right at 12 hour difference.
Pretty much there.
We did an interview with a gentleman from Australia and another gentleman from New Zealand, and so these time differences are always fascinating, trying to negotiate times.
Yes, very difficult when you're on this side of the world. But great to see you. Yeah. Thanks for having me on.
Hey, Alistair, yeah. why are you on that side of the world?
Well, Asia has had a growing addiction problem. My feelings are it needs an entire paradigm shift in terms of talk therapy. You know, it's modernizing. People have got the same problems that humans have got everywhere, especially when their society starts to get more complex. They have family problems and emotional and mental health problems, and there really isn't a lot here. And that's true generally of mental health, not just addiction. So there was, from a business angle, a gap in the market, and from a humanitarian angle, a need. So we started in Chiang Mai in northern Thailand, which is has a bit of history as a healing capital. It's very different to what your image of Thailand might be in the south, the beaches and so on. Chiang Mai is mountainous and a spa town, really. A healing place.
How long have you been in Thailand?
We've been operating here for 8 years. So we're probably the biggest addiction healthcare provider in Asia now. Yeah.
Yeah, we're in Asia.
Yes, in the whole of Asia. Yeah, addiction-specific part of behavioral healthcare. Obviously, there are a lot of big conglomerates, but as addiction specialists, we're a small multinational now. Yeah.
Okay. Wow, that's fantastic. And where are you from originally?
Originally from London in the UK, and my background was working right at the other end of the spectrum, really. With what we would call in the UK the public sector, so I guess what you guys might call not for profit, but it's really the government funded sector, in one of London's more notorious boroughs, Haringey, which is a very probably similar, something similar to the Bronx or something like that, and working primarily with street drinkers and crack cane users. Who were government-funded for treatment. So then I did about the same amount of time there, about 7 years in that, and then I decided to go into the private sector and try something new. I felt I had more ideas that really needed. I needed to own my own or be a part owner of my own organization in order to develop my treatment philosophy.
Mm. Well, excellent. I definitely want to talk to you more about your center in a bit, but so that was you kind of answered my question as I was going to ask it. That one of the shifts was made because of the interest of being able to do things that you maybe couldn't do in the more public sector.
Yes. I mean, in the UK, we have we may cover some of this ground, I guess. The UK, Australia, New Zealand, Scandinavia have very specific philosophy with regard to addiction that's kind of diametrically opposed to what you have in the States, actually. Canada's probably up there with the UK as well. They're very libertarian, which is fantastic. And they're very pro-harm minimization, which is absolutely needed. We need needle exchanges and things like that to prevent spread of blood-borne viruses and so on. But the baby gets thrown out with the bathwater a little bit because abstinence-orientated treatment programs, which are awesome as well, are underrepresented and under-promoted, I felt. In the UK. That's not a problem you have in the States. You have the opposite problem, probably. You have a lot of private treatment centers and 12-step-based programs, and not a lot of harm-min. In fact, some harm-min procedures like needle exchanges, as I understand it, might even be not legal in some of the states. So, you know, you almost have the opposite problem. And I'm up for both, but I felt that it was unbalanced a little bit in Northern Europe, yeah.
Oh, all right. Yeah, it sounds like there's some significant differences, you know, between some of these different areas. So we'll definitely get into some of that while we're talking today.
Yeah, we rely on the 12-step program primarily. I think that's the most popular and most used. But you're right, there are state-to-state differences regarding needle exchange programs and the use of other medications.
Yeah.
To replace addictions.
Yeah. So you were saying before that there's a growing, there was a significant need there in Thailand specifically, but I'm supposing in Asia in general, of some substance abuse treatment programs. Here in the United States, we have this massive movement now starting. Mm. We're calling it the opiate crisis.
Opioid crisis.
So it sounds like some of these issues are global. Is that what you're seeing?
Yes. Obviously, we treat a huge amount of foreigners. In fact, predominantly foreigners, predominantly Westerners, because we're a private treatment center. But we also take Thai nationals and Chinese nationals and a lot of Australian nationals. So we are probably quite close to being one of the – we're probably the most multicultural – large private treatment center in the world, I would say. You know, we have Taoists and Buddhists and Hindus and Jews and Christians and Muslims in treatment every single day of the year. So from, you know, probably 20 or 30 nationalities in treatment every day of the year. So what we're seeing with the opiate epidemic, if you want to call it that, in North America, is part of a pandemic. So, you know, opiates and methamphetamine-based drugs are epidemic in lots of hotspots in the world. So that would be certain parts of the United States, particularly, strangely, the Appalachians and places like that. Same in rural parts of Australia. Also, the same in certain communities in urban areas in Australia and London, particularly the gay community and so on with certain drugs. So there are hot spots. Also, northern Thailand is a hot spot for methamphetamine production, which is not widely known. It's the Golden Triangle area that was opium producing is now methamphetamine producing. So you see these crises, and perhaps also in the Middle East with heroin, because it's grown at source there. And there are different reasons why those epidemics grow and flourish, but that what we need to understand is this is part of a wider pandemic, which is global. It's on every continental shelf. There are reasons for that that are to do with modernity and our adaptation to post-industrial era, really, I would say, which doesn't take away from the fact that it's also a childhood-based illness. It's an adolescent illness, but the roots are strong links. The roots are in adversity in childhood. So the Center for Disease Control and Kaiser Hospital Group and academics like Frank Felitti have done a lot of work on adverse childhood experiences, and they've catalogued them and researched them in huge, huge surveys. And this is not a middle ghetto underclass problem. You know, most of the 17-odd thousand adults that were put through the ACE study, the Adverse Childhood Experience Study, were from middle-class backgrounds of various ethnicities. And what they found is out of 10 common childhood adversities, ranging from having a sibling in prison to a parent with a personality disorder or divorce or bereavement and so on, all the things you might expect that boil down to abuse, neglect, or household dysfunction, that if you scored highly on those 10, not only would you be much, much more likely to be an injecting drug user, but you'd be much more likely to be a heavy drinker, a heavy smoker, or obese, and therefore die of illnesses, which I often think are secondary illnesses to a primary illness, which we currently call addiction, which isn't a very good word for it. But I see impulsive and compulsive behaviors like smoking and drug taking, etc., as the primary illness, and the lung cancer as the secondary illness. Now, the World Health Organization wouldn't see it that way, but that's what I see. And this is to do with, so it's to do with childhood, it's to do with how our younger generations are raised. And underneath that, though, is what sort of world are the parents living in? So it's this, there's so many levels to addiction. It affects humans on every level of their being, you know, physical, biological, environmental, psychological, existential, spiritual, the whole gamut of human experience.
Alistair, when you said that the Chiang Mai, is it a province or a region?
Yes, province. That's right.
You said it was already known as a place of healing.
Yes.
What was the fundamental philosophy that was used there?
Buddhist meditation. So Lanna used to be a separate kingdom from Thailand, from Siam. Mm-hmm. The Lanna culture is sort of halfway between Burmese culture and Thai culture. Obviously, it's all part of Thailand now, but the Lanna kingdom had a specific branch of Buddhism called Vipassana, which you all now know as mindfulness. Yes. What we commonly call in the West mindfulness, it has its roots in Vipassana. So those psychologists and Buddhist teachers that began popularizing quick and easy secular meditation techniques in the 70s and 80s, John Kabat-Zinn would be a good example of someone people might know. He's a popular American meditation teacher and a psychologist, I think. Massachusetts, is he? One of the really good academic centers in the States. And obviously, mindfulness is used in offices, in stress reduction, for depression. So the NHS in the UK prescribe, if you like, mindfulness software modules and things like that to help people deal with depression. And that's attracted Asian nationals from China and other Buddhist areas to northern Thailand over centuries, really. And so it's a very long tradition, and there are a lot of very large temples that do organize 10-day retreats. So in northern Thailand and also in Sri Lanka, you will see a particular type of meditation called Vipassana, which demands a 10-day retreat. When the reason is very specific, because 10 days is the time that's been found to cause some kind of brain change, I presume. And most people will bow out around 3 or 4 days is when they're feeling quite confronted with themselves. And it's not recommended for, obviously, people who have had, you know, recent bouts of psychosis and things like that for that reason. It's quite confronting. But we use it in small, manageable chunks in treatment. as well as Muay Thai boxing for young men. So we use some quite odd techniques in addition to the usual ones, like, you know, the variants of CBT, some 12-step philosophy, and so on. You know, we put it together so people have a range of options because everybody's obviously different. Each client is different.
But before we move on to a couple of other things, I have a question that I don't even know if you and I have really talked about this too much. Richard and I talked about all kinds of different things sitting around. But I wanted to make sure, I wanted to ask you this, and it's sort of out of left field. So if you want to put your thoughts together some first, then that's great. You were talking a moment ago about like early, you know, these adverse childhood events and some of these things that we know or seem to be predictors in some ways of substance use and increased prevalence of and risk of substance use. And so we see those kinds of tendencies. We see, and we know that there are certain characteristics and traits that may make a person more or less at risk. And you mentioned sort of the existential type of crises and things that we need to talk about. And at the same time, we refer to much of what we do about with substance abuse as, you know, especially, well, here in the States, at least, I'm not sure if other countries do the same thing, but in the States, we refer to it like the war on drugs. And it makes it seem very confrontational, very like us against them. We are at war with drugs. And oftentimes that includes the person who is abusing substances. And I would love to hear your thoughts about that. I know it's kind of out of left field, and if you want to put your thoughts together some first, that's understandable.
Yeah, no, I've got very clear views on that, and there's a very clear movement that's developing around it. I mean, there's obviously a very well-known book that your readers might want to check out by Johan Harry called Chasing the Scream, which is a very interesting book. It talks about the way that Billie Holiday was persecuted right at the beginning of the war on drugs. There's some very personal examples, and sort of ends with the sort of conclusion, you know, spoiler alert, that the war on drugs isn't working because it pathologizes addicts, obviously, rather than the illness itself. And this is all stemming out of a white paper, I think, a white paper that was released by the London School of Economics probably 4-5 years ago, I think really set the tone for this. You have other theorists like Gabor Mate in Vancouver, that Dr. Gabor Mate is a very good addiction doctor. So there's a rising movement that we should not really be placing the amount of funds that we're placing in border checks and sort of semi-military exercises on crop eradication. And it's all about the amount of money you spend on each sector. How much money do you spend on stopping drugs getting to your country? How much money do you spend on putting dealers in jail? How much money do you spend on treatment? How much money do you spend on education? And everybody agrees, and the white paper that the LSE came out with said we need all of them, but currently those first two, the sort of policing and the sort of military involvement globally, not just the American DEA and so on, but also operations going on, say, here in northern Thailand to eradicate methamphetamine production. It's relatively unstoppable. And actually what they found is causes more violence, because you eradicate a gang in northern Thailand, yeah, and it creates what's called a bubble effect. And there's a war between the next three lower-ranking gangs, during which there's a huge amount of bloodshed, and one of them reemerges anyway as the new top gang. So the demand is there, so the supply will be there as well. You know, so there will always be dealers, etc., and criminal organizations. So one has to ask, if you even manage to get on top of the drug problem and prevent people from wanting drugs, which is going to be very difficult, they'd move into something else anyway. So it's a big movement afoot that the war on drugs is not working, that we should be spending more money on education and treatment. I say that education is quite problematic as well, because when people say, what preventative work can you do with addiction? I say, not much. And then they look very confused and slightly crestfallen. And they say, what do you mean? And I say, well, you can make a childhood between a decade and a half of childhood much better, if that's what you mean by preventative work. How's about rearing children that aren't likely to be traumatized and therefore use drugs? And again, I'm not talking about kids in ghetto underclass. I'm talking about kids from every socioeconomic group. If you fancy doing 15 to 20 years of really awesome parenting, you won't have somebody who has a predilection for using drugs. You just won't. And that I'm quite, you know, and that's not, no parenting came with a parenting manual. You know, it's not just the parents. It's the neighborhood. It's society. It's very, very easy to go wrong as a parent. It's, you know, that's not a damnation on parents. It's just what I'm saying is, the preventative work is not going to be a load of shiny booklets or TV commercials. It's right. All the kids know in a country like America or the UK what drugs are which and what they do and what the risks are. They know those things. They are likely to use them if they are feeling meaningless, unrewarded, unguided, or at loggerheads with the surrounding culture, which is not just their parents.
Right.
So preventative work is societal. It's a really huge job. I know it's way beyond the scope of this program, but the war on drugs is obviously, by the same token, really rather hopeless. So we need to be putting money into treatment and then perhaps general psychological well-being for society or the young generations, not just addiction warnings. You know, that won't work. It just won't work.
Right.
Alistair, you mentioned that it's safety, it's a search for safety and meaning, or the absence of safety and meaning, that drives addiction. How did you arrive at that? What was your journey, or how did you arrive at that focus?
Well, on one level, I'm quite a reductionist thinker. So when my clients in treatment, especially those who are more rational, they might be a doctor or they might be a professional man in their mid-30s or 40s or something like that, or a headmaster perhaps. And they say, you know, it's not working for me, Ali, this 12 steps and so on. And I'm very all-inclusive. So I go, okay, let's break it down then. What if you had a neurophysiological talent for being addicted? Do you think that might be likely? They said, yes, I've thought of that. And so then we start to talk about how addiction at its roots is, it doesn't define the whole of addiction, as I said, because addiction comes on multiple levels. But at its root, it is a neurophysiological condition. Usually, people who use drugs and alcohol and other behaviors to self-medicate were ill before they did it. They were already ill. And the amount of nodding heads you get when you're running group therapy with addicts and you say, do you recognize these symptoms? Restlessness, irritability, discontented, lack of meaning, lack of purpose, even when you're doing something that should be meaningful, like being the president of the United States or a father or, you know, something which has inherent meaning. Those things haven't stopped those people from becoming addicts, even though they had a post or a role in life that was full to the rafters of meaning, with meaning. It did not stop them from becoming an addict because neurophysiologically they're not well. So there is a biological basis to it. So that's how I first started to think about it. And then, I mean, you all know, you're psychological professionals, you know the links between dopamine and addiction, and they are overbloated sometimes, those links. But one interesting exercise you can do is to think about addictions. I think you had a previous podcast called Why Is Everything an Addiction? And I agree with that. It's this kind of ridiculous, the trivialization of addiction. People say they're addicted to all sorts of things that they can't be addicted to. But we can pretty quickly work out what you can be addicted to using a funny or quite old-fashioned model in psychology called Maslow's Hierarchy of Needs. Now, you guys will be familiar with that, but your listeners might not be. So Maslow had a pyramid of human needs that go more or less one by one. And the bottom one is breathing and eating. And then it moves up to being warm and having a house. And then it moves up to being loved and feeling like you belong, and moves up to being esteemed for what you do and getting what we call respect these days, and finishes off with, you know, hobbies and creative pursuits. And obviously, if you're being strangled currently, you're not bothered about whether your house is on fire, you know. And if you're, you know, looking for esteem but not getting it, then you need to sort that out before you can become spiritual or take care of your existential needs. Now, all of those things that are on that pyramid can be addictions. And the reason is because they're all things that our dopaminergic faculties evolved to help us get. So initially, our mammalian and reptilian progenitors evolved dopaminergic pathways to get food and sex. And then as mammalians sort of evolved further, that included bonding and a sense of belonging, nurture, being groomed, things like that would have stimulated our dopamine pathways. And then, as you've said in previous posts, more or less anything enjoyable. But the thing is, addiction's got nothing to do with enjoyment and everything to do with survival. So the word reward is a very different word to pleasure. So reward addiction is a reward deficiency kind of syndrome or condition, and that's got nothing to do with pleasure. So we're looking at people who are either naturally unrewarded because their brain chemistry works that way, or their environment has made them that way, will seek rewards. And not all rewards are pleasurable. You see? So if you ask any addict if they enjoy their addiction, they will give you a resounding no. They are taking heroin because of the meaning that they find in heroin. Heroin is a resource which helps them get up in the morning, get out into the world, fight off enemies, and survive. It's a resource. So you can place it on Maslow's hierarchy of needs. People who don't have any belonging in their childhood, no sense of esteem that was given to them by parents, elders, or society, will recruit that feeling through more or less any highly dopamine-enhancing experience. But the kicker is, you can get that from a life of meaning as well. In fact, the most strongest kind of release of brain dopamine that you're going to get is going to be a quasi-spiritual experience. So that's where you get your spiritual programs coming in, and that's why they work. They work the same way that drugs work, just at a higher level of the pyramid. So that's how I came to that. And as far as I know, not too many other people have made that connection. The dopamine connection is obviously massively researched and completely understood. But the range of human behaviors which stimulate dopamine is very large, but there's only certain of those behaviors that are highly and naturally and adaptively rewarding. In other words, we evolved that way. So you look at gaming addiction. Well, it's exploring. You know, it probably is addictive, gaming, and I'm a bit nervous about video gaming because it's extremely constructive as well in the right settings. That's the thing about video gaming, is it's a very constructive thing as well. But it could be addictive, you see, because it's a primate behavior. Right. It's an ape behavior to explore further and further our horizons, and that's where the biggest and most clean hit of dopamine is going to be found, is in living a better life, a more meaningful life, a life full of purpose. And I think, you know, most addicted people hearing this, they'll probably be nodding their head because that's been their experience.
That's fascinating. I really appreciate your description of that and explanation, because I think that's one of the big debates, controversies when it comes to substance use and those who become addicted to various substances or behaviors and I like the way that you connected it to Maslow's. And you use some of these terms because it's something that we've talked about with some of our patients, and we've talked about it on programs in the past, and that is the idea that the perspective that for the vast majority, if not all, individuals with substance abuse issues, addictive issues, there is some other underlying something, whether it's a mental health issue, it's a personality issue, it's a social issue, as you mentioned, a medical issue. There's typically something else there. And I think that, you know, my experience has been that the place that most programs seem to fall short is that they omit that piece. They focus on the substance use. And so they, you know, the goal is, you know, you're going to spend 28 days here so that we can get you, you know, get the substance out of your system. And then we're going to send you back home. But they're not doing anything to manage the root cause of the substance use.
Yes. I mean, that because we're such highly social primates, I mean, you gather I'm an evolutionary thinker, probably a bit more than a developmental thinker. I mean, I'm both. I think, you know, we've got to look at our brain, how it's been evolving since we were born, or not evolving, but how it's been changing since we were born. Our environment definitely affects us. It really, really does. And also the way that our human brain, which is quite pretty similar to start with in all of us, has been evolving for millions of years. And as I said, we're highly social primates. So a lot of our meaning comes through social belonging. But the fact is, most people who become addicted will at some point in their life, before they started using drugs and alcohol, have said to themselves, I'm so bored that I would rather risk more or less anything than stay in this state of ennui, what we'd call in sort of psychological parlance a state of ennui, a state of mind-bending boredom. Now, that probably does have biological basis and an environmental cause and all sorts of things. But the point is, some middle-class kid sitting in Idaho is feeling it just the same as some tough kid in New Orleans or whatever. You know, the similarities are in the person, not necessarily the socioeconomic group. And I think that that's a societal problem. I don't think that medieval young men, let's say, would have really had the time to have felt so mind-crushingly bored or asking themselves a question, who am I? Because they were too damn busy surviving. And so right. We say things like, oh, addiction's caused by trauma, which it is. Addiction's caused by poverty, which it is. But the fact is that most of the world's poverty-stricken and traumatized people aren't addicts. That's the problem with that one. You know, most of the kids in sub-Saharan Africa must be partly traumatized. I mean, sub-Saharan Africa's got a really high rate of childhood soldiers. You would have thought right. They'd have the highest rate of addiction. Now, they've got a pretty high rate of cannabis use, but they don't have very high rates of other drugs. And the answer to that would usually be, oh, they can't get their hands on it. There's not enough money. Those drugs aren't available. I don't really think that's it. I think addiction is not caused by, for a start, it has no causes. It has risk factors. And when those risk factors start to line up, you're in trouble. But really, it's not even, and those would be biology, environment, and access to drugs. But even more than that, it's not to do with those. It's to do with a lack of protective factors. And those protective factors might be stability, intimacy, traditional culture, meaning you're a 9-year-old, 10-year-old kid, you get praised for taking the goat herd out if you're living in sub-Saharan Africa, or you get praised for playing football if you're in, you know, the USA. Erickson's model, if you like. The idea that we have needs as we develop. And if we don't get those needs met as a 2-year-old, an 8-year-old, a teenager, and there's very specific needs at each, you know, to have independence, to be praised, to have a feeling of belonging and like the world is a safe place. If those things are missing, you wind up as a pretty poorly developed primate. And those things seem to be more missing in modern society than they are in traditional cultures. So even in somewhere like California, you'll find that after earthquakes or natural tragedies, people who are from immigrant groups who have a still very intact culture will deal rather better with the trauma than Americans. And that is what causes addiction, in my view. It's a lack of meaning. So it's boredom, lack of meaning, lack of purpose. The idea that almost anything would be better. Offending criminal behaviors, taking drugs, you name it. Young men in particular have to have an odyssey. Otherwise, they might not, as well not be alive. They have to have something engaging to do. And it doesn't quite answer the problem with young women, who I do think are slightly different. But again, we could probably base that back to the meaning that they should be getting from family and or if not family, the surrounding culture. Because the family might be quite strong, but the surrounding culture needs to be strong as well. The parents need support too.
Right. And certainly the expectations we put on each other. Right. You've mentioned a lot of different things, different treatment ideas and different ways in which we kind of think about and approach substance use. Tell us a little bit about your center. I saw that it's been referred to as sort of the Betty Ford of Asia. So it's a very, it's a brilliant looking facility. So tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah, I think that's probably quite a good comparison, because we're a bit of a flagship, a bit like Betty Ford is. I mean, Betty Ford is very traditional. It's an awesome place, really, you know, what they've done over the years. And we have tried to do something like that in Asia. We're progressive at the same time as being quite middle of the road and traditional. So we try to keep the traditional treatment methods that work and bring them to Asia, which obviously doesn't have much experience with them. Things like abstinence-based philosophy and 12-step fellowships and support groups. And we've kind of swollen the fellowships really in Thailand from what they were, just because of the amount of alumni that have left our center and gone on to stay clean and sober and build the fellowships here in Southeast Asia. So that's a source of pride, really, I guess. But on the progressive side, what we tried to do was obviously use the local resources, which is and incorporate them into a treatment program in a really interesting way. And Vipassana or Theravada Buddhism, Vipassana or mindfulness, if you want to give it a secular title, works really, really well with traditional American treatment methods like abstinence-based philosophy and 12-step sort of facilitation, if not 12-step, you know, you can't do 12 steps in treatment centers. Obviously, it's the principles that you're imparting. And so we do that via mindfulness a lot. So there are a lot of parallels between Vipassana practice and 12-step principles. Most specifically of all, you can deploy mindfulness onto cravings. So I use particular psychological interventions to treat particular parts of the illness. So one very distinct part of addiction, which everybody recognizes, or should we say a talent that addicted people have that non-addicted people don't, is the ability to crave strongly, which is to, you know, one of the things which causes recidivism. Or relapse, as most people would understand it. And there are neurobiological reasons for that. It's a memory illness at heart. So our mammalian brain, our emotional brain, is highly implicated in addiction, and we even build what researchers have called neural ghosts. So when you stop using, you'll have lots of neural ghosts, lots of ghosts in your brain that are haunting you of your, more or less anything that reminds you of your addiction will haunt you. And that's because those pathways have been laid down and washed over and cleaned and strengthened by dopamine.
Right.
Particularly by dopamine. And those highways will be very wide and very fast, and they won't die off or wither away very quickly. So one of the psychological techniques you can use is mindfulness training. So mindfulness training in the temple would be you're sitting in an uncomfortable position for hours on end, and when your back aches, you just repeat to yourself that your back is aching slightly with your internal dialogue, and then you breathe, and then you repeat, you talk to yourself again, and then you breathe. And eventually the discomfort subsides and you realize you're not going to die because you've got an uncomfortable back. And should you choose to move your position, you do very slowly and mindfully. So you'll move very, very slowly like this. And so we use that with cravings. When you have a craving, you can go into meditation and repeat to yourself internally, I'm having a craving, I'm having a craving, I'm having a craving. And then breathe. And that's effectively really a behavioral treatment. It's really action. It's actually kind of rewiring you, if you like, in terms of your neural connections and strengthening your ability to delay gratification in an action-based way and weakening the connections that are connected with having a thought of using and immediately phoning up your dealer. You're interrupting and breaking that connection, and that's literally on a brain level. But of course, the trick is you have to do it again and again and again, as with anything in life. And therein, I guess, lies the value of residential treatment programs, is you are really, in a way, forced to consistently do things over and over again. And that is how you bed things down in your brain and create change. And we know that now. You know, we know that our brain's relatively plastic, at least parts of the brain are, and we can change them over periods of 2 and 3 months if we do things repeatedly. So there are lots of books on that are popular bestsellers. Norman Doidge's book, the name escapes me now, something like The Plastic Brain, those kind of, The Brain That Changes Itself. That's a great popular book that people might want to read about neuroplasticity. So we brought the traditional Western methods over here to Asia to benefit Asian nationals, and we've used local methods that Westerners find really compelling and complementary with what they're used to. And that's been a fairly powerful mixture, I would say.
Sounds like it. Yeah. So it sounds like, again, you use a variety of methods, because I know that, you know, one of the things that we've encountered, because we've specifically talked about how, you know, some people are more inclined to go in one treatment direction or another treatment direction. You know, some people are very opposed to like the 12-step type programs, and others are somewhat resistant of even meditation-based types of treatment. It sounds like at your facility, you guys work to incorporate a bunch of different techniques so that you can meet the patient or the client where they are and provide them whatever it is that is going to connect with them.
Yeah, well, what I've found over the years, and this is not just working with higher socioeconomic groups, this, I also did this in Tottenham in North London, was start everything with psychoeducation about how the brain works and how addiction works. That's completely secular and factual. Talk about how the brain works in very basic terms, and then it tends to make sense from there. So then you say, well, the reason why 12 steps kind of tends to work is because we're social, we're mammals, you know, and we are inherent. Even psychopaths are social, you know, even psychopaths need somebody, even if it's just to torture them. You know, we're social primates, it's what we do. You know, we have to be with people, otherwise we become ill, and addiction's an illness where you will isolate. So that's why 12-step fellowships, for example, will talk about not isolating, and we do therapy in groups. And then he might explain how CBT works. Well, you know, we have our reasoning faculties are impaired in addiction. So we can't really trust our thinking. You always think you can trust your thinking. Well, you can't. So, you know, as Albert Ellis said, don't believe what you believe necessarily. And so, again, that then vindicates being in groups and doing group work where you can be challenged not just by counselors but by your peers. So if people have a rough understanding of how their brains work, what sort of creature we are, you know, highly social mammals or primates that whose reasoning is impaired by certain illnesses like addiction, then it starts to make a lot more sense why they need to do the things they need to do. I wouldn't ask anybody to do anything that they didn't want to do without a very good explanation. And most addicted people don't want to do treatment because drugs and alcohol are the only things that ever worked for them to get them not being symptomatic. And now all everybody else wants to do is just take it away from them. And that's like being blind and having a medicine given to you that helped you to see. And then 10 minutes later, everyone comes along and they want to take it away. I mean, you'd be grief stricken. And that's the situation that the addicted person is in. They very literally, you know, they have a disability.
Right. It certainly sounds like it's the approach has to be holistic. Yes. And I read that on your website that you guys take a very holistic approach.
Yeah. The physical element is also a very big and overlooked element in my view. A lot of treatment centers are nervous of physical activity because of the way that it can be misused by people with eating disorders and so on. Well, it's very easy to assess those who've got bulimic tendencies out of being able to over-exercise whilst they're in treatment with you, and very easy to allow people who are under-exercising and sedentary to do more work. And absolutely crucial, I would say, given that we know that the sort of good neurochemistry that's produced by exercise, fairly intensive exercise, actually, you know, doing a little bit doesn't do you much good. So especially with young men, we have a separate young men's program called The Edge. And that specializes in triathlon and Muay Thai kickboxing. Most of the boys tend to go with triathlon for obvious reasons, but some tend to go with the kickboxing. And so there are various reasons for that. There's the great neurochemistry, the encephalins, the endorphins, all those nice chemicals that every addict wants. You can get them naturally by slightly over-exercising. And that's not a bad thing with young men if it means that their recidivism is going to be brought down. So we've got to weigh the dangers of this young man having bulimic tendencies and acting out with his exercise versus him dying of a heroin overdose. Right. And I know once he leaves treatment, I know which side my money's on. So I take a slightly different view to a lot of American treatment centers in that regard. I do not consider running machines and weights and things like that to be some kind of work of the devil. I think that they're absolutely crucial for recovery, especially for young people, because they get into such mind-numbing boredom periods, even in treatment, that they need to be kept busy. And with the kickboxing, there's an added twist, which is it has a kind of Jungian element to it. So your listeners might not be familiar with Carl Jung, who's not so fashionable these days, but in essence, Jung was a colleague of Sigmund Freud's, but he differed from Freud in that he thought that addiction was a spiritual illness as such, and he was a bit of a precursor to 12-step fellowships in that regard. And he thought that all addicted people were engaged in a search for meaning, and I think that's true. And you see it with young men. They don't have a challenge that's engaging enough to keep them out of trouble. And so right. What they want is some safe, manageable chunks of danger is what they need, or some of them do. And as a society or a culture, we need to make that available again, because it's not, and it's damaging, and it's not how we evolved.
Right. Alistair, in our work here in our clinic, we always emphasize the value and the contribution of sleep, nutrition, and exercise. What do you do in terms of nutrition? Is that part of your treatment?
Yeah, it is. We've got a nutritionist on site who's, it differs slightly between the main program and the young men's program, because the young men are effectively athletes, so they have to have a fairly high calorie diet. But the main program, we are very light on the carbs and sugar. In fact, the sugar's, you know, pretty much out of the diet. And the carbs need to be quality carbohydrates, brown rice, whole wheat, pasta, things like that, lots of salads. Fruit is not to be overconsumed, so we only make fruit available and fruit juice and things like that only available at certain parts of the day, because we found that people were binging on it. Then you have the coffee machine as well, which needs to be removed for most of the day for the same reason, because when people are in treatment, there's a reason why people in treatment immediately try to engage in romantic relationships, start smoking twice as many cigarettes or drink twice as much coffee, because they're desperate to recruit as much brain dopamine as they possibly can, because they just lost their main source. And so nutrition has to be good for that reason. It also has to be good, obviously, for the reconstitution of their brain and body. So Thai food's pretty good. It's a pretty good starting point, Thai cuisine. for a healthy diet. So we haven't had to, you know, create huge menu lists. It's just the traditional Thai food, sort of reinforced with salads and an idea that the carbohydrates have to be slow release, not nasty white rice and white pasta and white bread.
Perfect. Yeah. Well, we have kept you for quite a while this morning/evening. And so anything else that we haven't really touched on that you would want to share with the listeners, certainly like how they can follow you, where they can learn more about your program and what you're doing?
Mm-hmm. The Rehab's website is www.thecabinchiangmai.com, or they can just do www.thecabin.com and then get to our various centers through that. I'm on Twitter, YouTube, and Facebook as Alistair Mordy. That's A-L-A-S-T-A-I-R, and Mordy is M-O-R-D-E-Y.
Perfect. And I'll include links to all of that in the show notes so people can check that out and follow you and see some of the work. And it's fantastic stuff that you're doing. It's
wow.
It's impressive compared to some of the things that we're doing here. We feel somewhat hamstrung here sometimes that we really can't get some things going and approach things the way that we would always like to. So. Yeah.
Thanks for having me on the show, guys, and good luck with your work.
We appreciate it. And the same to you. Anytime you ever want to come back, if there's anything else going on, you know, just reach out, let us know, and you're always welcome to come back on.
Be a pleasure. Thanks, guys.
All right. Great. Thanks. Have a great day. Bye-bye.
Bye.